Hey, welcome back. This is Deanna, and our next guest is Peter Myers, and he lives in Australia, and hopefully he is joining us momentarily. We'll have to wait and see here. hopefully he will join us. When you're on the program, you have to accept a Skype invitation so that we can bring you on. I interviewed Peter Myers back in on March 1st, 2012. And of course, since then, he's published a great deal of information on his website. And his website is, I don't know how to bring him on. The producer has to bring him on, and he has to accept the invitation. It's okay. Okay. Then what do I do? Dang. Search box. In the search box. Okay, yes, okay. Add to call. Okay. And then I just type it, or I just, okay. Hang on. Peter, I'm trying to add you. That's why we have this wonderful producer that takes care of all this stuff. He's just great. Okay, add to call. Let me just, add to call. Okay, add to call. Okay. Okay. Oh dear, down at the bottom of the box it says add. Okay, I'm calling him right now. Is that working? There he is. Okay. All righty. See what a great producer we have. Is that not marvelous? Peter, welcome to the program.
Thank you, Deanna. I thought I didn't get your invitation. I thought something's gone wrong. I might not be on, but anyway, here we are now.
Yes, here you are. I don't personally send out the invitations. Our producer does, and maybe you didn't recognize it. Whatever. Hey, you're here. That's the important thing, is that you're here. And I was telling the audience that the first time that I had you on the program was back in on March 1st, 2012. And you've published a great deal on your website since then. And I will post your website in our chat room. And when I had you on the program back then, we were talking about a lot of things. And some of the things that we talked about, let me bring up my notes. I keep notes on everybody. You have your own file. You were talking about Chomsky and how the left had given him a free ride. And you were talking about the power of the Jewish lobby and how it manipulates presidents and Congress. And you were talking about just a number of things. You talked about the Kissinger memo to Nixon, about the nukes. And I have 12 pages of notes from that one program, 12 pages of notes. And so we must have talked about a lot of very, very interesting things. Well, I know we did, but that's been it's been quite a few years.
Well, and for today, Deanna, you told me you would first like to talk about the wildfires.
I do, absolutely. I want to talk about the wildfires because we hear about it. I'm an animal lover, and I see these little koalas being burned.
Well, that's right. If you drive along some of the highways in Australia, you'll see signs for animal rescue organisations and the phone number. If you see an injured wildlife by the side of the road, and the implication always is it's rednecks who are killing these wildlife and greens that are saving them. But we have a phenomenon in Australia called the green bushfires. And this term was first used about 2004 in connection with bushfires that ravaged Canberra, destroyed about 400 houses. But before they reached Canberra, the capital city, they had gone through hundreds of miles of forest, bushland, we call it. The reason that they were called the green bushfires is that green lobbying had stopped harvesting of timber in a lot of these forests. They had been state forests in many cases, which meant that timber would be harvested. State forests were run by the Forestry Commission. And then the Greens lobbied to get them changed to national parks, which were run by ecologists. So they kicked out the foresters and put the ecologists in charge, and they stopped doing preventative burn-offs. There used to be grazing leases in these forests whereby cattle and horses were eating the undergrowth to help stop fires. They got rid of the cattle and horses, no more grazing leases. They also put gates across a lot of their dirt roads, and they put locks on them, padlocks. And it meant that this was to stop rednecks from driving their four-wheel drives there. But in emergency situations, like when fires are coming, a lot of the time these gates were still there and inhibited access. And so that's when the term green bushfires first became used. And yet the same situation still applies today. And during the terrible bushfires of the last few months here, the media basically fell into two camps, the green camp and the other camp. Well, the green camp were the Australian Broadcasting Corporation, which is like your PBS, publicly run. PBR, is it? PBS over there. They worked in conjunction with print media in the Fairfax companies, which have a newspaper, well, online newspapers in every state and print newspapers in Sydney and Melbourne. So they were taking the green line that these bushfires are caused by climate change. And then the Murdoch Press, Rupert Murdoch owns
right
major papers here. The Murdoch Press were publicising the other view, was that these bushfires were caused because there'd been a build-up of fuel load, meaning combustible material in the forests, and they hadn't been doing burn-offs to reduce it. So these two groups were talking sort of alongside one another, as it were. The Greens paid no attention to the other argument. The other argument did mention the Green argument, but what their response was, well, suppose that climate change caused these bushfires, then if you were to do what the Greens want, say, for example, shutting down coal-fired power stations and also natural gas, because natural gas produces methane when they're mining the gas. So if you did that, and you did it in China and India too, and there was a switch towards renewable energy, it would still take 30 years or so for the Earth's climate to go back to what it was a few centuries ago. And in that 30 years, if climate change is causing these bushfires, and they're not recommending anything else, any other way of dealing with them. So this was presented in the Murdoch press, and you couldn't get that sort of view. Oh, no, I must admit, there were a few times I saw such a view on the Australian Broadcasting Corporation and the Fairfax media, because the fires were so terrible this year that they had to consider those options. And I think the government here, which is more in the Trump camp than the other side, the government here will hold a royal commission into these fires, and the royal commission will do what other royal commissions have done into bushfires in the past, and basically saying they haven't been burning off as they should have in years before the fires, and recommend that they do it. And then the state governments, who are in charge of such things, will just continue not to do it. And one of the reasons they don't do it is in forests that are close to cities, they say, oh, well, they're going to produce smoke, and smoke's bad for asthmatics and people like that. So, and another reason they don't do it is that they say the window of opportunity is shrinking, meaning the number of months you can do burn-offs each year is shrinking because the climate's warming up, so we have shorter cold seasons and so on. And what that really means is that if you've got both public land and private land, and so we're talking about public land now, and that means because these forests basically are national parks, that means getting the national parks rangers to do the burns, and or I suppose perhaps contracting other people. But basically they're bureaucrats. When the forestry ran these forests, the people in charge were foresters, and they used to charge money for the timber that was harvested in those forests. So they had a vested interest in maintaining a stability, both in terms of the productive side of the forest, but also ensuring the longevity of the forest. They wouldn't let it get burned to a crisp. So they used to do preventative burns and have cattle and horses there as well. With the Greens having stopped logging and stopped harvesting of firewood, they also promoted what's called softwood substitution in buildings. So we used to use our hardwood timber for buildings, and now they use softwood timber, which is like what you use in the United States, and basically radiata pine in this country. And they also use more steel, which is not good from a green point of view, and they also use more brick, fired brick, which is also not good from a green point of view. Anyway, so these green bushfires roasted millions of koalas and other native animals. And you can imagine when they do preventative burn-offs, they're done in the cool months, The fire usually has people looking after it to make sure that nothing goes wrong. The fire doesn't get very hot. The animals can smell the fire, and if they can move, like kangaroos, wallabies, and so on, they will move to another area. They will move. Whereas if they're in a tree like a koala, they can't. But the cool fire doesn't really hurt them. Whereas when they allow the fuel buildup to get away, then of course all these animals just get roasted. Now, also, I need to mention the Aboriginal method of managing these lands. Aborigines used to do burns on their land, about a third of their land each year. And they didn't do it because they were ecologists. They did it to get food. And so the when they did a burn, and these were slow burns in the cool months, the kangaroos and other animals would escape by going to an area that was burned previously, and that would now be like a pasture. You know, after the burn, you get a lot of regrowth, so it's quite green there. So what the Aborigines were doing was driving their prey that they used to hunt from the area that they were burning to an area that they had burnt last year. And that is why they did it. And they did it in a lot of areas now that are being allowed to just grow wild without any management at all. So Aborigines are some of the people who are calling for a return to more traditional fire management, because in many areas they lost important memorials, markers from their old culture, which were destroyed in these fires.
Wow.
Another thing is that on private land, these days, say, if you want to do burn-offs, you have to get a permit or face a big fine. And so you've got this bureaucratic system. And what they ought to do is, just as in dangerous times, they have news. The news tells you that the fire danger is high. In times of the year when the fire danger is very low, people who live in rural areas should be allowed to do burn-offs without permits. I mean, I've done it years ago when I lived in Tasmania. My neighbour and I did burn-offs. We didn't get a permit. And, you know, most people who live in those areas, as long as you're doing it on your own land and you're looking after the fire, you shouldn't really need a permit. They should allow, you should issue permit-free days in the news and the weather reports for certain times of the year, so that you don't need a permit to do the burning off, and you get the bureaucracy out of the way. And also it costs a lot less, because every time bureaucracy is involved, you've got a cost. They'll charge you a fee, and there's paperwork and all that sort of thing.
Wow. This is a terrible situation.
By the way, there's one other thing I've just noticed. I've got a few notes to mention.
Now, okay.
These fires were terrible, and California had terrible fires too. And, of course, we had a terrible drought that preceded the fire. So I imagine that's what happened in California. And droughts could be a sign of climate change. I don't deny that the polar areas are heating up. The ice caps are melting in Antarctica and the polar and the North Pole. And the reason I know that is that I check a site or what's up with that, which is basically, it's an anti-green site organized by Christopher Monk, and it gets the data.
Peter, I'm sorry, we do have to take a really quick 3-minute break. We'll be right back. So stay with us. Be right back.
You and me, it starts with you and me. We all can be heroes if we take
all righty. My guest this last hour of the program today is Peter Myers. His website is mailstar.net. I will post that in the chat room. And you were talking about the ice caps melting and interesting things.
So, I mean, I'm not denying that's happening. But with regard to this, they call it climate change, and I think it is probably that caused by people. But the climate has always been changing as well. And with regard to the fires, the fires were preceded by droughts, a terrible drought in Australia. And you would have had one in California as
right.
well, your fires. Now, this drought that we had was caused in the Indian Ocean, which it goes between Australia and Africa. And in the northern part of the Indian Ocean, there's a measure called the Indian Ocean Dipole. Well, it turned out that sea temperature was a lot lower on the Australian side than normal, and the temperature was hotter on the African side. And they got a lot more rain in East Africa than they normally do, double the rain. And we got hardly any rain. So it's the same sort of thing that happens across the Pacific Ocean, where it's called El Nino. I mean, sometimes the western side of the Pacific Ocean, that's Australia, gets a deluging, and the eastern side, Chilean side, is in terrible drought, and vice versa. Anyway, but I wanted to mention that some of the great civilizations in history have been destroyed by drought, and one of them was Angkor Wat in Cambodia. There were very bad droughts in the 1300s and 1400s. And they had a system of canals and reservoirs in Angkor Wat. And when this terrible drought happened, I believe they widened some of them to try to get water, what water there was, through. And then later they got a heavy monsoon again after the droughts finished. And then it washed a lot of sediment, filling up their reservoirs and canals and things like this, and destroying their hydraulic system. So it's worth checking that out, because when people do blame things on climate change, you need to point out that this happened well before the industrial era. And also the Maya civilization of Mexico suffered terrible droughts, which seem to have caused the decline of that civilization. So there might be a lesson that we shouldn't overstretch our luck and make too many demands on nature. That would be a good lesson. But at the same time, to imply that climate change is unique to the industrial era, that's wrong.
That is very interesting.
Some of the people who got affected by our fires were the hippies of Nimbin. Nimbin is a town which hosted a festival in Australia, which was like the Woodstock Festival over there. And after that festival, a lot of them bought up former dairy country and had bush blocks and so on. And in that area, they campaigned to stop logging in the forests, state forests, and turn them into national parks. And now, after years of not harvesting timber there and stopping burn-offs, now they've suffered terribly in these recent fires. So the Murdoch paper called The Australian had a headline, Hippies of Nimbin admit Bush got too wild. And Aborigines were also saying that the country got too wild. In other words, when they used to do their cool burns, it was managed, and now in the green era, it was just allowed to go unchecked. And then they all paid the price when their homes got destroyed.
Wow.
I had an email from somebody who lives near Nimbin. He said, our son David, who lives at the commune near Nimbin, it's called Tuntable Halls, had his house saved by the fires yesterday, means by the firefighters. And you know, these firefighters were all volunteers. They never got paid a cent. Now, this fire season was so much longer than usual that the Prime Minister felt shamed into offering them all a $3,000 fee later afterward, after the firefighting. But they were all volunteers.
Wow. Okay, we are going to a quick 3-minute break. We'll pick this up on the other side. This is great information. Thank you.
With you and me, we all can be heroes if we take the lead to change the bad to good, to live in harmony. It starts with you.
All right, welcome back. Our guest this last hour is Peter Myers. His website is mailstar.net. This is fascinating information, and I know that they also stopped the logging industry up in Oregon, Washington, and other places, and that has affected the growth of trees and probably the possibility of fires.
That's right, and when people build houses from these timber trees, that is a form of carbon capture. In other words, the house is made of the timber, and the timber is taking the carbon out of the forest and into the house, and it was thus there for decades, a long, long time. And where they cut that tree down in the forest to make the house, another one will grow. And if you give up timber housing, then you're going to be using brick, steel, you know, and they are environmentally bad. So timber housing is good housing. And unfortunately, the Greens here have contributed to a reduction in timber housing. I was just reading a letter from someone who lives near Nimbin, and he said our son David, who lives at the commune near Nimbin, had his house saved by the firefighters yesterday. This is, he wrote this about 6 weeks ago. The fuel load up there was enormous, and by fuel load they mean all the undergrowth that was it was allowed to build up. There were no cattle or horses to eat it. There were no burn-offs in the cool months, so there was a huge fuel load, and that makes the fuel load makes the fire get very hot and fierce, ferocious, so they can't stop it. Whereas if they do burn-offs and there is a fire, then the fire will be a lot cooler and easier to manage. This guy says his son has been out there for days helping wherever he could. In other words, he'd help to try to fight the fires. He's an expert with chainsaws and was able to get one started, which a fiery had a lot of trouble with. So he's very lucky so far. The cool southerly today could send the fire back up where it came through yesterday. So that was an email that I had. Some of the firefighters who were saving other people's houses came home later and found their own house was gone.
Oh, dear.
Yeah. And in some cases, people who stayed home to try to save their place died. I mean, other people were successful in that, but it's very scary. Well, I don't know what sort of investigations you have over here, but we are part of the British Empire still, and we will have one that's called a Royal Commission. And hopefully all of these issues will be raised, and hopefully there'll be a better fire mitigation regimen put in place. But you wouldn't be sure.
It is amazing to me. I just had not looked at this in the way that you are explaining it, and certainly did not know about earlier situations where this might happen. Of course, when I saw on television the news about these poor little koalas and the devastation to the country, that is what I thought about initially.
It's not only koalas that got roasted in the fire. They're not the only ones who suffered, because the others who survived then would not have been able to find food, because so much devastation. You know, they need these trees for food. By the way, our forests here are mainly eucalypt, and your forest there would be largely pine and other softwoods. I think you've probably got some hardwoods there too. But Australia is a very dry continent, but it used to be wetter some millions of years ago. And we used to have pine trees here too. And in some areas they survived. There's a group that was thought to have died out in New South Wales. New South Wales is the state, which Sydney is the capital. There's a pine tree there called Wollamai pine, which they found had survived for millions of years, unknown. And then in this area, there's hoop pine and bunya pine, and they all grow in wet, well, they all love water. They grow in wettish areas. And the whole continent used to be a lot wetter. When it dried out, that is when eucalypt trees spread over this continent, because eucalypt trees survive fire. So that someone was telling me yesterday, she went to Melbourne from here in Queensland, Brisbane, say Brisbane to Melbourne, and drove there, and the whole area was black and burned. And then during that 2 weeks, there was rain. On the way back, the same route, everything was green again, because the trees regrow, they reshoot. And, you know, you would still see probably the blackened ground, but the trees already were regrowing.
Wow. Yeah, that is amazing. Just the difference in the type of trees.
Yeah. Well, the other thing about eucalypt trees is that they use them for paper pulp. They're very fast growing, and they are many species are strong for building, and they're a lot stronger than say radiata pine. Radiata pine might have a stress grading of 7. If you're lucky, or 5, you know, run of the mill, whereas hardwood eucalypt will have a stress grading of 12 or 15. Some of them even have 18. I mean, there's one here called ironbark, and you pick up a piece of ironbark, and it weighs, you know, maybe 5 or 10 times the amount that the pine, radiata pine would weigh.
Oh.
I mean, yeah, they're very, of course, they're slow going too. Yeah, and not only that, so when you're doing building with timbers, you can use a lot smaller dimension, like typically a bearer in a house. In the southern states, they use 4x2 hardwood, but here in Queensland, it's common to use 3x2 hardwood, because the hardwood here is slower growing, but it's also stronger. So I've got, in this house here, it's an old Queenslander house. Some of the bearers are only 3 inches by 3 inches, and they're ironbark. But they're just so strong, you know. Anyway, so that I really get upset that the Greens have been shutting down our hardwood timber mills. And they do it partly by persuading the building industry not to use it. If you know, these days with the building industry, they are using gyprock and other flat cladding, you know. And that goes on a pine very easily, and they can use nail guns and they also glue it. But a hardwood timber for building does bow a little bit. You know, the issue, they dry it, and but it's not as good for something like gyprock. You can get cracks in it. So, I mean, I've done some building here with this, and I used masonite because it's got a bit of flexibility. But anyway, in the past, the builders used to use hardwood for building houses, and they would put packing behind any spots that needed it if they were going to be using a rigid cladding like gyprock, a lining, what do you call it, internal lining like gyprock, and rigid external cladding likewise. You know. But anyway, so the Greens helped persuade the building industry to give up using hardwood timber and use pine timber. And also, pine timber is vulnerable to termites, whereas hardwood timber is much more impervious to termite damage. And so termites will get into a house, a hardwood house, and eat part of the house and then leave because they don't really like it all that much. But if they get into a radiata pine house, they'll just eat a lot. There'll just be nothing left, you know. You poke your finger through the wall and there's nothing there. Wow. Anyway... Yeah, so I get upset about that. Another thing about the radiata pine forests or other pine forests in this country, because they're not native, they're silent places. There's no native animals. There's no birds singing and so on. In fact, I'm next to an avocado orchard here, and it's silent. I mean, at my place here, I've just got 3/4 of an acre. And we have birds singing all the time, you know. You know when morning's coming because you can hear the birds sing, you know. They're the first to see the sun coming over the horizon and they start singing at an early time. But you walk into the avocado orchard, that's an avocado orchard with, you know, many square miles, you know, tens of thousands of avocado trees. There's no birds singing there. It's silent. And it's the same as that in the pine forest here that they're using. They're growing now for housing and so on. So I get really upset. These people call themselves green, but actually they oppose our own native, using our own native trees for building. And they sort of got sawmills shut down all over the place. And they attack them from all sides. One of the ways they attack is try to... stop the demand for their product. Well, I mean, I'm not a big fan of the coal industry, but they're doing that too, aren't they? I mean, they go to insurance companies and they tell them you've got climate change coming and therefore you've got to put the price of insurance up. They just attack in every way. Now, I might, if you live me a few minutes, I'll just talk about this coal industry because there's a lot of politics to do with climate that connected with our coal industry.
Sure.
We have in Queensland is it corresponds to your southeast states, you might say. It's a bit like a big Florida. It's much bigger than Florida, much bigger than Texas. You know, it's about a fifth of the or a quarter of the whole Australian continent is Queensland, and it has enormous resources of black coal. And the railroad system in Queensland is narrow gauge, 3.6. And they were late to electrify, but when they did electrify, they went to 25 kilovolts AC. And that means that they can have electric locos pulling very heavy loads, like ore trains. And so these railroads are all narrow gauge, but they pull enormous ore trains carrying coal, mainly coal, but there's some other minerals too. And these coal trains have an electric loco at the front, and then 40 wagons, and then there's another electric loco, another 40 wagons, and then another electric loco, and another 40 wagons. So the whole train is about 2 miles long.
Wow.
And you see these trains going to ports about every 15 minutes or so, going from the inland, which is the west, to the coast on the east, pulling these long trains about every 15 minutes, and they're going to about 3 or 4 ports up and down the coast. And these ports run 7 days a week, 24 hours a day. They're pulling these trains. Well, one time my family and I were travelling around in 1996, and we went to a tour of a coal mine at Blackwater, and we got lost. After that, I was taking a shortcut, going to a place called Charters Towers, I wanted to bypass Emerald, and I think I was heading for Clermont, but I got onto the wrong road. And we went past, we were on a dirt road, we got lost, we went past all these coal mines with huge mountains of coal, and there were train lines, railroads everywhere, you know, pulling, you know, to collect this coal and take it to the stations, take it to the ports. Anyway, I just realised the enormous amount of coal they were pulling out of Queensland. I thought, we are taking too much coal, and I do believe we ought to leave some for people in the future. But on the other hand, we had an election here in Queensland where a politician called Clive Palmer ran ads saying, Don't give up the coal industry without a fight. Well, there's a lot of people in Queensland who work in these coal mines, and they're largely fly in, fly out, or drive. You know, they work basically about 3 weeks on and 1 week off. And the companies used to put them on 8-hour shifts, meaning that there would be 3 shifts a day.
Wow.
But then they changed to 12-hour shifts, so there are 2 shifts a day. And it was a big election issue, and the Labor Party, no, this was a federal election as well, the last federal election, the Labor Party lost because they had secretly been going to shut down the coal industry and so-called retrain the workers. That's what they did into the Tasmanian hydroelectric industry, shut it down. So anyway, it was a big election issue. But at the same time, I mean, I can understand that the workers want their jobs, but I think if you want to compromise, you've got to stop the 12-hour shifts and go back to 8-hour shifts so that you employ 3 shifts, you employ more people, and the company is going to have to pay more food and have more accommodation, but on the other hand, there's a lot of red tape or green tape at these mines, which is occupational health and safety stuff, so that an electrician that might be or a tradesman doing a 12-hour shift might spend an hour and a half doing paperwork at the start of it, just filling out all the forms for the things he was going to be doing and the risks and so on. And even if the job in hand was only a job that required a few minutes, they have to fill out reams of paperwork all about the risks. So what I would suggest is the government ought to get rid of all this burden of red tape and green tape, cut the shifts to 8 hours, and that way we don't have to pull out so much coal, but we keep the employment.
Right. Okay, let's pick this up on the other side of the break. This is very interesting. We'll be right back in 3 minutes. All right, we are back with Peter Myers. And this is such interesting information. It's just very interesting. It just seems that that mankind is working against nature and against the environment, just in the interest of business and money.
Well, that's right, and I think that even those of us who oppose world government, we need to consider the environment too. So the green left are the globalist left, and I like to think of myself as green right, but I'm not a fanatic. You know, I support the family and traditional values. And I believe in a mixed economy where big companies are brought to heel and big pharma likewise. But at the same time, you need private enterprise. And this was the mistake that they made in the Soviet Union. They got rid of all the private enterprise. But I think you can go to the other extreme. I think perhaps we've gone to the other extreme. So, that's right. So, if we are the green right, it means leaving some for the future, and whilst avoiding waste. I mean, there's so much waste. You think of how washing machines, all sorts of white goods, for example, only last a few years now. They used to last 20 or 30 years. Now, that's all. They all go to the tip. I suppose some of them get recycled, but there's so much waste, and that means we're going to mine all these ores, you know, iron and stuff, to make these things that are only being used a few years. And take mobile phones. How long do they last? And they make them so you can't fix them. So many computers are not fixable. So, I mean, we don't have any vested interest in the throwaway culture. We ought to insist that everything that you buy is maintainable and fixable. I mean, I have an issue with car batteries right now because I had to get another car battery in the car just this last week. Well, I knew that the battery would run out this year, and you can't get batteries that you can top up now. They're changing them all to so-called maintenance free, but maintenance free is just spin. It means it's not maintainable. I mean, if you've got a battery in your car and you check the level, the water level, or electrolyte level, you only need to do that a couple of times a year. It's not a big deal. It's not a big problem to check. And then if it's down, you can top it up and that battery will last a lot longer. Whereas if it's maintenance free, it's sealed. And it dies. And the other thing is they die suddenly. Maintenance-free batteries just die just like that. And you could be in a remote spot and you're really stuck.
Right.
But this is just another example of the throwaway culture. It's a maintenance-free battery. It is actually a throwaway battery that you can't fix, you can't maintain. So the same applies to computers and so many other things.
Plastic bottles. Yes.
We can sort of be environmentally responsible too.
Yes. Well, thank you so very much, Peter, for being on the program and talking about the subject.
The time seemed to go fast.
Yes, it did go by really fast. We'll have to do this again soon. So thank you so much. Yeah. Take care.
Bye.
Bye-bye. Bye-bye, listeners. Talk with you next week.